Hello and welcome. This is a new episode of Neuland, a podcast from the campus here at the Hasso-Plattner Institute. Today, we have a special guest, Alexander Kuscher. 15 years ago, he completed his bachelor's degree in IT systems engineering at HPI. Now he is the senior director of product management at Google. Alexander joined Google in 2010. He has worked on various projects related to mobile advertising, the Chrome browser, and Chrome OS. He also holds several patents in the areas of computer hardware, user interfaces, and advertising technologies. Today, he's leading the software product team for Chrome OS, managing a global team, and despite his international work, Alexander has still strong ties to HPI. It's great to have you on the show. Welcome, Alexander.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's great to be back.
How does it feel? How does it feel to be back at HPI?
I mean, it's amazing. Whenever I come back, which I've done more often recently, something is changing and something stayed the same. I joked yesterday with someone that every time I come back, there's a new building. And then they were showing me a place where they're building a new building. So the joke's on me, but it's lovely to see some of the core ethos still here and then see how things change. But then I think that the semester just began and seeing young people for the first time taking, I don't know, their mathematics lecture is kind of amazing.
Do you have bittersweet memories as well? You were young back then. The world was wide open. You enjoyed student life.
I actually have, well, yes and no. I think when I came here, and many students might feel like that, it was definitely a shock in both a positive and a negative way. Mm-hmm. Like in the, I think it's always positive, but I think what shocked me is, you know, you come here and then you're surrounded by incredibly smart and talented people, which gives you a shock. It's like, oh my God, they're all so smart. And like, you know, am I good enough for this? And then after a few weeks, you look around and you realize that everybody asked themselves that. But that's definitely scary at the beginning. So that's sort of like the oop moment. But then it turns into something cool because you're like, oh, these people are all like driven and interested in the same things. And then you realize it's a pretty special environment that's hard to recreate.
What motivated you back then to study at HPI?
Mr. Net, the figure on the...
That was the reason?
No, not really. I'm just amazed that that's still around. It was fascinating. My brother actually drove me here to check it out. And we went to a few places, you know, your usual computer science universities in Germany, like TU Munich and whatnot. And we came here, my brother drove me at the time. And what was unique here is that there's a professor who welcomed me and sort of showed me around and talked to me a little bit about the HPI. And I saw sort of people, I saw students in the corridors. It was like very, it almost felt more like a startup than a university. And the fact that a professor met me and talked to me, I was like, this is different. So let's do this.
And how did your time at HPI shape you?
It taught me a few things that I kept using in life. I think the most important thing is that the HPI sort of taught me to, I learned to learn in a way. It's like at the beginning, I was like, okay, I'm going to learn this programming language and I'm going to learn this theoretical concept and then I'm going to use that the rest of my life, right? And I was like, no, like by the end of your studies, that programming language is already forgotten and not cool anymore and that something else is better. But the HPI taught me how to acquire knowledge. And like that just served me an incredible amount. The other thing that I think is, it sounds sort of stereotypical, but it is really true. We did a lot of team projects, right? Something like the bachelor project is such a unique idea, where you work in a team with other people, with a partner, and all the challenges that come with that, right? Like engineering is easy, communication is hard, we sometimes say. That experience working in teams and some of the courses working in international teams is something that served me incredibly well going to other universities or going into work. So I think those two things really, really stay with me. Sort of abstract, but therefore useful.
Can you remember any special moment?
Many. I think one of the earlier ones was we had a database systems class with Professor Naumann, who's still around. And we built a system that collected information on celebrities. Yeah, go figure. Mm-hmm. But he thought that's kind of cool. And he asked us, hey, do you want to do this over the semester break? Improve it a little bit and write a paper about it. And the payment, so to say, we got was free pizza and a room, which, you know, as a student, is that's currency.
the pizza.
So, yeah, and the room. You know, I was like, oh, we had a fancy room with couches and we have pizza in it. Like, what else do you need? But that was cool and sort of already different. And then we submitted the paper to a conference and it got accepted. And later won the Best Paper Award. And the conference was in Beijing. And here we were kind of just asking Professor Naumann, like, can we go? Normally the answer would be no, right? It's just like, you're an undergrad student. Like, you know, wait for your PhD for this. But then he's like, no, you go. And yeah, it wasn't like easy. Like, it was four of us in a hotel room in Beijing in some dodgy motel. But nevertheless, we got to go. We got to like sit in a plane and see Beijing. It happened to be during the Paralympics as well, or at the very tail end of it, which we didn't visit. But just making that possible, I think, is a special memory. I have another one if you want one more.
Yeah, sure.
That goes sort of the, well, don't accept boundaries or push them a little bit at the very least. There was a really, really cool course called a global design course. That was a course where HPI master students, Stanford master students, I think some South Americans, Finnish, would all come together, different disciplines, mechanical engineering, computer science, and they would solve a global design challenge with a project partner for a year. It was a really cool course. I was like looking at that. I was like, this is so amazing. It was for master students. And two of us, we were bachelor students. We were like, well, let's just apply anyways. And normally, again, you know, there's some rules and you say, no, you can't do this. But here we were asked, like, well, make a pitch. So we made a pitch and you know, eventually they allowed us to do it. And again, it's like that sort of gave me the bug to go to Silicon Valley because it's the first time we went there and we got to see, oh, look, this is how Stanford students behave. Yeah, kind of the same as us. And this is how the Valley works. So again, those moments are, I think, special and also uniquely HPI in the way they happened.
And you graduated from HPI in 2009, went on to Stanford, and then joined Google in 2010. Things moved quite quickly. How did this all happen?
Well, it took a few detours, actually. I always tell people I very slowly moved westwards. So I actually went to the UK first, to Cambridge, to do my master's there. And people ask me, like, oh, do you not like the HPI master's? And I was like, actually, I love it. But the HPI, so it's its own fault. It pushes you quite a bit into, like, go explore, try something. So it's like, all right, I explore and do a master somewhere else after that experience in the design course. So I went to the UK because I didn't want to go quite as far and did my master's there. And I always had the idea of doing an academic career. But the HPI has a lot of real, like, you know, it's in the engineering, it's very practical. So that bug stuck with me. And then while I was in the UK and about to start my PhD, Google actually came and was like, hey, do you want to do this thing called product management, which I had no idea what it is. And I said, sure, where is it? And they're like, well, it's in Mountain View, California. I'm like, oh, okay. So I thought, let me go there for 2 years and then come back. And that was 14 years ago. I guess you could say I'm bad at long-term planning.
And now you're responsible for the software product team for Chrome OS. What is the biggest challenge in your job right now?
What's the biggest challenge in my job? That changes by the day, but I'd say that, you know, it's when you're building an operating system, which really underlies a lot of other products. It's sort of what runs on your mobile phone, or on your computer, and it's kind of only a container for the things that the user really wants, right? You're trying to build something that, in an ideal scenario, nobody knows is there. Like, you know, as much as I love my product, I don't think you pick up your phone or your computer and be like, I'm going to use my operating system now. It's like, no, you want to go to Instagram or the internet or do something, write an email. So building a product that kind of is behind the scenes is something that I find super interesting. But it's also really, really challenging because it's a good example of where you have to remind yourself that you are not the user either. You're not the consumer because, like, I love this stuff, but yeah, the users don't, like, they don't necessarily care about this. So really remind yourself of that. I think that's a big challenge, just of like ensure that you keep remembering that you're not the user. And that then applies you know, globally. So you have to really understand, like, also the users are not the same. I think the other challenge, I think, is funny. It really harps back to the global design course at the HPI. Is my team is, I think you mentioned in the opening, my team is pretty global. I was last week in Tokyo actually seeing them. There's some in Munich, there's many in Mountain View and San Francisco. So it's a global team, which is amazing because it reflects the user base we have as well, which is also global. So you have that combination there. But it also is a challenge communication-wise, right? Try doing a meeting between Tokyo, San Francisco, and Munich, and you know, somebody's going to wake up early or stay up late. And there's different cultures, right? The culture map between those teams is different. And like handling that is actually really complicated, and no traditional computer science degree would really teach you that. And oddly enough, the HPI did expose me to that in my bachelor's, and that's pretty cool.
So how much time do you still spend on coding, if any? Or is it all about leadership right now?
I don't think my engineers would let me code anymore. I think somebody would probably come in and smash my laptop. I think it's interesting. So I don't code very much, but at Google we have this belief, and this is, I think, in most tech companies, good practice, that you need to maintain as a leader at those companies, you need to maintain technical depth and technical insight. And that needs to be there. You need to have that. Because there's a litmus test there, knowing, like, is this hard or is this easy? Will this take long or will this be slow? If you don't have that intuition, if you can't look at that, if you can't understand that, then as a leader, you kind of make decisions that are based in very little, right? Then you know, any slide deck can be presented to you and you'll be like, oh, this is very, very hard, good to know. And I was like, no. You need to have some critical thinking there. So I don't code anymore, but I like to believe that I keep the technical depth there, because that's really what, like, that's where I come from. I think that's where technical leaders should come from. So whenever people ask me about, like, how about management and leadership? I'm like, this is important stuff, but the core is, I think the HPI talks about the T-shaped human, right? And Stanford does the same. So you have to have your depth. And I think, you know, my depth is technical. And then you layer on at the horizontal of the T, the other pieces, people management, creativity, design, those things. So I think that is, that's a key aspect to technical leadership. The other thing, by the way, is everything changes, right? The technologies that we interact with change dramatically over time. That's another reason you have to sort of stay abreast of those changes, right? When I started out in mobile advertisement at Google, we didn't think much about AI, like, you know, machine learning, like, oh yeah, we'll use a little bit of it. And it was like, you know, transformer models weren't around. So stuff like that changes so fast. And I mentioned at the very beginning, the programming language changed. So
the pace is fast.
The pace is super fast, and you need to be interested. I think the answer is you need to be curious. Like, if you're not curious in leadership, then you're kind of not going to have you're going to know what the next thing is, right? You're not going to understand, like, what is the next technical innovation that you might use or your team might use.
And what kind of user feedback has had the most impact on the development of Chrome OS? How do you gain a solid understanding of what the customer really needs?
That's interesting, the user feedback. I think the first thing is users will use your product not in the way that you think. I think it's like people are really good at finding different uses for it and you sort of stumble into it. You know, for Chromebooks, for example, when we built them, we thought about, oh, let's build a very mobile, very internet-forward laptop for the future, because everything is going to move into the internet. It was a time of Web 2.0. The first stuff like that came out. We're quite excited for that as a consumer product. We thought people would be really interested in it. And then some schools started using them instead. And they started bringing them to classrooms. And they found that that's actually a really good market fit. And we hadn't really planned for 30 school children using these devices. But we built Chromebooks that they're really easy to share. And our idea was like, oh, clearly you share them in your family between mom, dad, the children. But then what they actually did is they gave that Chromebook to 30 different students throughout the day, which was not how we expected it to be used. It was not perfectly built for it, but the basics were there. So I think there's the user feedback part is always interesting because they're going to use it in different ways. And sometimes it's really good to follow the users in that way, right? Like, follow them to what they're doing with your product, versus like trying to force your vision.
Because it's unexpected.
It's unexpected, and sometimes it gives you actually insight about the true value of your product, mm-hmm. that you may have not known a priori. You had some insight. In this case, shareability of technology was the insight. We just had a different idea of where it goes than the users. I think in the industry, there's many examples. I think YouTube was a video dating site at the beginning, but the insight was video is big. And it turns out not for dating, but for, I guess, cat videos. or Instagram was, what was it? Bourbon. It was a location photo site that people used to share pictures of bars. And now it's, you know, Instagram. So I think just following the users where they go is sometimes really useful.
Yesterday, we had a very inspiring alumni fireside chat. And you have been on the panel, and a student asked you quite directly, what is it like to work in Silicon Valley? And is it really worth it? That's a good question, right?
It is a great question.
And is it worth it?
All right. So first of all, I love the question from the students. Like, they were not holding back. Which is how it should be. When my plan, by the way, I was pretty down on Silicon Valley before I went there. Yeah, I was living in the UK. I was like, oh yeah, I love Germany, I love Europe, but I'll try this America thing. I'll try this California thing for 2 years, right? Like, and then I come back. And again, I mentioned this 14 years ago, so something happened. I think I would recommend, and I recommend that to the student, to everybody. Try it out. Like, exposing yourself to a different society, a different culture, in this particular case in Silicon Valley, exposing yourself to the pace, the diversity of thought, the diversity of people. Like, in San Francisco, you always joke at parties that finding somebody who is actually from San Francisco is pretty unique, and everybody's like, oh my God, you're from here. How weird. Because everybody's from somewhere, right? Like, you're on the Pacific, like, you have a lot of Asian influence, you have a lot of Europeans. So it is actually the melting pot that I think in high school, you know, they talked about America. And that you feel there. And then you have the technology sector there, which still is where, like, you have all the VCs, you have the big companies, you have the startups that come and go, like, quicker than you can imagine. I do sit in one of my favorite coffee shops, Tartine. I hope it's not an advertisement.
No.
The Tartine is a coffee shop / bakery. And if you just sit there, you overhear some young founder pitch some VC. You overhear two employees from Apple very quietly talking about something because it's a secret. You overhear, like, people from different companies just having fun. Like, that's just, that vibe is really hard to, it's really hard to describe, actually. And it's really amazing to see that sort of flux. So I'd recommend it to that student and to anybody. Like, it is worth it at the very least for a while to have experienced that, and also to have built that network there that you can take back. I've seen many people who came and then went back, right? They went back to Berlin, or they went back to London. They went back to Beijing. But, like, having that stint there, like, it is still where a lot of our industry really, really sort of gels.
In your coffee shop, people are talking about artificial intelligence as well, right? Because it's the big thing for years now. What's your take on this?
So funny enough, Tartine Manufacturing is like two blocks down from the OpenAI headquarters.
Oh, wow.
Before they moved. So it's like...
Everybody's talking about it.
Seriously, it's like, it's hard to not run into an OpenAI person there. I think they moved now, but they were like two blocks away in the mission. I mean, AI is fascinating, and, you know, at Google, I like to say we have been at this for a while. I think it is one of those interesting innovations. Like, let me go a bit broader here. This is something that I recently talked and heard about. The sort of, if you look at the history of our industry a little bit, there, you know, there's mainframe computing, which was a big sort of like hardware innovation, and then there was sort of a tick, and there's a talk to, like, okay, now it's programming languages, object-oriented programming gets on top of that. The software part happened. Then there's another tick, personal computing. Oh, you can have a computer at home. And there's a tuck, the internet happened. These computers are now connected. There's another tick, the mobile phone happened. Now your computer is in your pocket anywhere. And then sort of what's the next tuck here? And that's really AI that puts now the power of your server into your phone. It changes the way that you interact with your phone. You think about agentic operating systems. You think about the abilities that exist for any kind of field, really, right? And, like, well, many of us thought that, you know, computer science is coming for the manufacturing jobs of the world, and it turns out AI is coming for information workers quite a bit. But not sort of in a negative way, but in a way that really dramatically changes what you do. But I think there is a few important pieces to keep in mind while we go down on this. I think it's a revolution, just like the others. First of all, it's a tool, right? And the tool is to be used by humans. So it's going to make us better at what we do. And we have to learn to use it, and it will adapt. But that's really exciting, right? Like, a lot of things you can do quicker with less overhead, a lot of, like, really menial things. Like, I do actually, I get a lot of documents to read. I love having AI summarize it for me. It's quite wonderful sometimes. Just get a summary. And if it's really important, I still go in and read, right? It's not like it can't replace my own reasoning, my own judgment in this case. But it can make the task of reading 10 papers way easier. So I think this is just a small glimpse in there. I'm not going to give you a lecture on AI, nor would I be equipped to do that. I think I want to do the counterbalance, though, onto this, which is, with any technological innovation like this, society is also adapting to what it changes in us, right? The internet, when it came around, was this Cambrian explosion of things. It was like, out of a sudden, all these people made websites, and all these amazing things happened. But also, a lot of, like, stuff happened online that we're not very excited about. We had to start thinking about, how do we as a society want to handle that? And how do we want to, you know, dare I say, regulate it? How do we think about privacy in that world? And how do you give people back controls? And all of that stuff. And we're still working through that with the innovation of the internet in many ways. And now with AI, I think we're actually a bit ahead. And the internet, we may be a bit more naive. With AI, we're asking these questions up front, right? Like, what does it mean to have, what does it mean to have an AI? And, like, how biased is it? Like, what is the data set it was trained on, right? There's a lot of examples out there. What does it mean for my privacy? What does ownership mean, right? Like, artists have pieces of their own work. Like, how is their ownership of that? What does real and fake mean? So I think there's a lot of, like, societal changes that are coming that we have to be active about. So as amazing as this innovation is, and as many fields it's going to impact in a really positive way, right? Like, we just had the Nobel Prize for AlphaFold, mm-hmm. which in medicine is incredible. Medicine is an incredible example. You got to have the other side as well and make sure that we're using it responsibly. And as a society, we deal with the issues that would come with any technological innovation.
Here at HBI, we are thinking about what's next as well. Do you have any projections, ideas? What's next?
Oh, gosh. Well, if I knew, would I tell you?
Yes, please.
I think there's a few things. I think in the very narrow sense, we talked about AI, and I think there's an adjacent field like BCI, brain-computer interfaces. I think that's an interesting sort of field for sure as a big next thing. And you probably say, no, that's now. I think there is a whole, is related to us, because everything is software now, of energy and sustainability, which I think is we're just starting to see what is happening in that field. And I think in a funny way, the needs that AI has in the energy sector are pushing that sector hard to innovate faster right now, because we're going to push up energy needs so much that we have to innovate there and really think out of the box and think out, how do we power this world and the increasing energy needs in this world sustainably. I think there's a lot of innovation in that one. Everything from, like, what do you do in microreactors all the way to grid management software. Like, this is a massively interesting field to me. I think biotech is the other piece of future that I would keep in mind for people that changes quite a bit now. I think I mentioned BCI, the brain-computer interface piece. That's sort of an interesting jump over into biotech and the speed of development, the speed of change that happens there. I'll give you two more. One that I think is happening under the sort of 10-year horizon, and one that we're seeing happening now. The 10-year horizon, I think, is the VR, AR, or XR change of the interface, right? And you might sort of say that's the TikTok again, like, oh, now the hardware changes again. I was always a skeptical of VR. It's like, I wear glasses, but I can't have the idea of a big headset on my head. But I could get the idea of AR, right? Like, I do wear glasses. I've used the Ray-Bans Meta glasses that don't do much more than having sort of a little bit of a camera on your face. But there's something interesting there of not having to take your phone out and having the AI see the world as you see. This can be really useful. And they just showed off Orion, their sort of actual augmented reality glasses. And that made me think that there's something there that, you know, not right now, but in the next 10 years, the technology is going to go to a place where enough of us will wear something smart in their glasses. And you're looking at me right now, and I'm wearing glasses, and like, they are on my face. They look at you this the way I do. And that context, and giving software that context, can be incredibly powerful. And also, for example, it can be really powerful for people with disabilities, right? Think blind people, deaf people. Like, that is an amazing way to actually change the entire paradigm around computing for people that still have a hard time to access it. So I think that's another aspect that is going to make a big difference in the next 10 years.
Having said this, talking about the future, what would be your advice for students at HPI?
Don't answer questions with long answers like I do, first of all. I think it's really, well, let's make it three things. One is build a strong foundation. At the very beginning of this interview, we talked about the fact that what I took away is that foundation in many ways, that technical depth. And yesterday at the event, a student also asked, like, oh, why do I need theoretical informatics? And like, why do I need math 301? And I'm like, you know, nobody will ask you to, you know, try to prove P equals NP in the future again, probably. But having an understanding of the complexity of an algorithm like that, I used that 3 weeks ago in a very high level sort of discussion, but it was there. And that depth really will be, it will just be in you and it's part of you. So do that and know that those courses, although hard and sometimes dry, really build a foundation that is worth having. I think that's number one. Number two, don't go it alone. I think there is always this idea in our industry, also a little bit the sort of, we idolize the sort of lone wolf, right? The Bill Gates who dropped out of Harvard and started, you know, the Zuckerberg, like, you know, those lone wolves who got it done by themselves. And those exist, right? That's kind of impressive. But then if you look at their actual histories or you look at many companies, it usually is teams of people who change something for real, right? And even those lone wolves had a lot of people around them early on. Together with them, they did something. And I think at the HPI, the same thing happens. And like, people are so open here. The classes are so small. So I think the second thing I would tell people is really look around. And like, there's going to be somebody there that you gel with and like work with them. And like, make this the team effort. And then the last one is just have fun. Like, this time is amazing. It's, I don't know, I always found it weird as a student when these people came back and were like, oh, I loved my student times. And I was like, and here I am. And I'm like, no, but it's true. Like, this is a special time. So have fun.
Have fun. And you have still such strong connections to HPI. That's not something to take for granted. So it's fantastic that you keep coming back as an alumnus. It's great.
Thank you. It is. I'll tell you one thing, though. I actually asked myself that when I flew here from Tokyo. I was like, why am I doing this again? And something that I think is came from a discussion I had with a student who was like, oh, we're not quite as famous yet at the MIT or Caltech or Oxford and Cambridge. You know, sometimes it's sad because somebody doesn't know that we are who we are and so amazing. And I felt the same way, actually, when I was here a little bit. It's like, this is so great. Why doesn't nobody know about this? But then the funny thing is, like, it is really special to be on ground zero at the early times here, right? It's just like, there was a time when Leland Stanford, like, started Stanford and nobody knew about it yet. And look where it is now, right? There was a time when the MIT was founded and folks were the first people there who took a chance on it, right? Let's take a chance on this weirdly named place on the cold East Coast. I think that's where the HPI is, sort of after 25 years now. It's like, it is still the early days. It is big enough that people take notice, but it's sort of, it is the exciting early founders times in a way. And that excites me, and that sort of gets me coming back. I'm like, I want to help this place in the little way that I can.
And maybe you build a bridge to Silicon Valley.
Absolutely. There's 50 of us there now. So, you know, it's
50 HPI alumni.
50 HPI alumni are in Silicon Valley, and we even have a group inside Google that has lunch once a month.
Great. Great to have you here on campus. Alexander Kusha, HPI alumnus and Senior Director of Product Management at Google. Thank you for visiting hear us on campus. And thank you for this great exchange.
Thank you. This is a blast.
And this is it for this episode of Neuland. And before we go, one last tip. We talked about AI. Don't miss the upcoming AI at HBI conference on the 3rd and 4th of December. Please find the invitation link in the show notes of this episode. This will be a great event. Join us and see you there. My name is Leon Stäbe. Thank you for listening. Till next time. Tschüss and bye-bye.